Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Lowy Institute. What a great turnout. We've got mostly women in the audience, I'd say about 10% men, so welcome, gentlemen. You're obviously also interested in women's economic empowerment. So my name is Cynthia Balog, and I head up the Women in Global Business Program at Austrade. Who's heard of the Women in Global Business Program? Yeah? Oh, good. So this is going to be a wonderful lunchtime series, and we're really delighted to have Arantxa Gonzalez here today and a number of events that we're going to be holding here in Sydney and in Canberra. She's a fantastic speaker, and I know you're really going to enjoy her presentation today. So without further ado, let me introduce Arantxa. Arantxa Gonzalez has 20 years' experience and is an expert in the international trade area. In September 2013, she was appointed Executive Director of the International Trade Centre in Geneva. She is a Spanish national and has extensive knowledge about international trade and economics in the public and private sectors, as well as in management of multinational organisations. Before joining the ITC, Arantxa served as the Chief of Staff to the World Trade Organization's Director General Pascal Lamy from 2005 to 2013. During her tenure at the WTO, she played an active role in launching the WTO's Aid for Trade initiative and served as Mr. Lamy's representative at the G20. Prior to working at the WTO, she held several positions at the European Commission, conducting negotiations of trade agreements and assisting developing countries in trade development efforts. Between 2002 and 2004, she was the European Union's spokeswoman for trade and an advisor to the European Union's Trade Commissioner. She began her career in the private sector, advising companies on trade competition and state aid matters. She holds a law degree from the University of Navarra and a postgraduate degree in European law from the University of Carlos III in Madrid. Please put your hands together and welcome Arantxa.
Thank you very much, Cynthia, and thank you to the Lowy Institute for putting on the radar a topic that is as incredibly powerful as it is underutilized. It's the issue of women's economic empowerment. If I think of the discussion in the global economy today, it's about secular stagnation, new normal, new mediocre, each description being more dismal than the last. But yet, what I see is an incredible waste of women's economic potential every day on a scale that to me is a bit staggering. Now, Australia is a bit better than most on this front. And in fact, tomorrow I'll be hearing a lot about that from Cynthia and the great work that the Women in Global Business has been doing in an event that she's put together in Canberra. But still, there is still a lot of work to be done, even in a country called Australia, which ranks only 63rd when it comes to equal pay for equal work. Now, in the 21st century, we would have thought that equal pay for equal job was like given, but it's not. Australia is number 63 in the world. So it means that although the message is there, although we know all these facts and these figures, maybe we are not speaking loud enough, and certainly maybe we are not doing enough in addressing all these facts and the figures that we know. So my presence here to discuss in a very serious and respectable place called Lowy Institute, a think tank that is known for being extremely good in progressive ideas, in progressing ideas. My presence here is to speak very, very loudly about women's economic empowerment, but also to give you a sense that each one of you, men and women, have a role to play in advancing it, in wherever you are, in whichever position you have. Let me start with facts and figures, because as someone that works in the economy and with the economy, I think it's the best place to start. McKinsey has recently told us, it's McKinsey, it's not me, it's not the International Trade Center, it's McKinsey. So serious stuff. They've told us that if women around the world participated in the economy on the same, with the same conditions, on par with men, which is not the case today, with equal wages, and in the high productivity part of the economy, then this would be like adding an economy to the world the size of the US and China combined together. This is what McKinsey is telling us. Now, let's imagine that this is the extreme, that this is the best case scenario. Let's go to a low case scenario. It's like adding either a China or a US to the economy. Still something not to be, let go. The IMF, another very reputable institution, thinks that eliminating barriers to employment for girls and for women could raise labor productivity by as much as 25% in some countries. And these are countries that include a very developed economy such as Japan. So hearing this, I say goodbye secular stagnation and mediocrity, hello equality and opportunities. Now, empowering women to become actors of change is at the heart of what we do in the International Trade Center. We were created 60 years ago as a joint venture between the United Nations and the World Trade Organization when countries realized that trade offers enormous opportunities to develop, to create jobs, to grow, but that this doesn't happen automatically. You still need to build a bridge between the world of opportunities and the world of realities. We focus on small and medium enterprises. Why? Because they employ the vast majority of people worldwide, because they are the vast majority of the backbone of our economies worldwide. And this is true in the US as it is in the case of Fiji, the country I just visited. We focus on trade because we know that SMEs that trade are more competitive, they are more productive, they employ more, and they pay better wages. But guess what? In a survey of 35 countries we have done, we have found that only 1 in 5 small and medium enterprises who trade are women-owned small and medium enterprises. So there is a huge opportunity if we combine these small and medium enterprises, if we combine trade. Of course, a big part of this SME world are women-owned small and medium enterprises, micro small and medium enterprises, shall I say. The question is, how do we combine the two to achieve sustainable development? Let me give you an example of what this looks like from the point of view of the International Trade Center. Let's take difficult markets, markets that are not necessarily at the heart of the global economy, Mali, Burkina Faso, in Africa, in conflict, with a lot of informal sector, with huge amounts of women in business. In our ethical fashion initiative, we've been working with over 12,000 women in these two countries, and Kenya, and Ghana, to connect them. These are women under less than $1 a day, so this is the furthest away from the market, to connect them to the high fashion markets through the Ethical Fashion Initiative. How? First, we've started from the market. We've looked at fashion houses that are interested in doing good as they do business, because the two are perfectly possible. We have worked it back to the micro producers, aggregating their production, improving their skills, working on quality, helping with design, and finally, with a lot of hand-holding on finance, making sure their products are up for consumption and are accepted and acceptable by these big fashion houses in the name of Armani, Stella McCartney, and Vivienne. This model works. We know that the social enterprises we have created in these countries have now been sold to investors that see this as a business model. So we are not talking about dreams. We are talking about something that can happen even in the most extreme circumstances, even in the most difficult countries, even in the northern face, we would say, if we were mountaineering. Now, today, in many places, the distributional aspects of trade have become a very hot political button. And you only need to switch on the television and hear what's happening in the US campaign to understand that trade has become a very contentious issue. While the lucky country might be something of an exception, perceptions are widespread that trade benefits have not been shared equally. They've not been shared in an equitable manner. Small and medium enterprises are a big part of making sure that the gains from trade are more equitably distributed as are women in business. That's why we are convinced that connecting women-owned small and medium enterprises to world markets is more important than ever. Globally, 3/4 of working-age men are in the labor force, compared to only half of working-age women. As we have seen, the macroeconomic consequences of moving upwards towards gender parity would be enormous. It matters at the national level. Countries that provide greater economic opportunities for women tend to rank higher on measures of national competitiveness. So there is a link between diversity and competitiveness of the economies. Frankly, if we were in sports, it's like leaving half of your team outside the pitch. It should be okay, right? If we were in sports, no coach would leave half of the team outside the pitch. But this is what's happening in a lot of our economies. Now, the consequences of the women's economic empowerment are no less dramatic at the household level. When women are paid for their work and have control over how the money gets spent, they invest much more of their income than men do in their families, education, and health. Again, this is not me saying it, because you would think that I'm pulling the rag in my direction. This is research that the World Bank has been doing for many years now. Literate fathers often have illiterate children, but literate mothers almost never do. Again, very interesting to remind us of the importance of ensuring more income is put in the pockets of women. Women's economic empowerment also makes good business sense, plain and simple. Greater diversity in senior management also makes for higher profit and for more competitive companies. And this is what Credit Suisse is telling us after surveying more than 3,000 companies. So what's true for economies is true for companies. It's true for households. Other research shows that firms with more women in senior roles are more effective at making the most of employee talent. And in spite of all this, in the Fortune 500, there are more CEOs named John than there are women CEOs. I want to emphasize that the gains are not just for big corporations. This is not just true for big companies. This is not just the case for big multinationals. Emerging firm-level evidence from the United States suggests that exporter premium, the pay premium at exporting firms over non-exporters, is higher for women-owned businesses than for those owned by men. So I would suggest that from all we hear, from all the brainy research that we know, it makes a lot of economic sense to empower women economically. We are doing that by connecting women entrepreneurs to markets, to local markets, to regional markets, to international markets. Let me give you 3 examples of how this looks like on the ground. And let me use the Pacific, because maybe this is a part of the world that you know well and would resonate with you. First lesson we have learned is that a big part of connecting women to business is talking about where the trade and the market opportunities are. So understanding where the markets are, understanding where the opportunities are, is step number one in connecting women to business. Second is obviously looking at helping governments have good policies, good trade and business policies that prevent women from suffering from specific barriers to trade compared to men, as is the case today. And I want to commend Women in Global Business Australia, because you're doing a great job at collecting this firm-specific data that we need in order to help governments understand that they have to change their policies and how to change the policies. In Papua New Guinea, we are helping Bilum weavers in places as far away from markets as Goroka to produce according to standards that you, as consumers, would want when you buy these products here in the high street in Sydney. In Vanuatu, we're working with the Hotel Association to make sure they buy more from women-owned enterprises for a big market called the tourism sector in order to promote the production of agricultural commodities in Vanuatu. In Samoa, we are helping procurement officers across the island in the different ministries to make better opportunities of a huge market called government procurement. Government procurement is a market worth $15 trillion every year. $15 trillion. And only an estimated 1% of this $15 trillion market is served by women-owned enterprises. Why is it? Well, often because the manner in which these tenders are crafted simply don't allow the smaller suppliers to be a supplier to the state. Often, companies have to pre-qualify through very costly procedures. So we have to unpack all of this so that everybody, big enterprises, medium enterprises, small enterprises, men-owned enterprises, women-owned enterprises, have access to this very lucrative market called public procurement. We have all heard this popular phrase that it takes a village to raise a child. Well, it takes even more than that to achieve gender economic equality, it seems. This is why last year, as part of our work, we launched an initiative aimed at connecting 1 million women-owned businesses to markets by 2020. You will tell me 1 million is small in the biggest scheme of things, since there are millions of entrepreneurs out there. My answer will be, we wanted to start modest, but show that we can deliver that by 2020. And if we have delivered more, great. We will set for ourselves even a bigger goal. We have called this initiative, She Trades. She Trades. This initiative has as at the heart of it a call to action to address 8 areas that in discussions with the stakeholders around the world we have understood are key areas that are limiting the participation of women in trade. 1, data collection. You know, I love the saying by Sheryl Sandberg. She says, what you don't know, you don't care. But once you know, you cannot but care. The problem we have is that we don't know. So gender disaggregated data collection, very important to make a case. 2, analysis and dissemination. Let's not sit on this wealth of data. Let's make sure that it's shared and it is connected. 3 is about trade policies, making sure they are not discriminatory advertently or inadvertently. 4 is about corporate procurement, supplier diversity. For those of you in the room that are entrepreneurs, think that when you buy, you can also buy with the lens that will help other women-owned businesses be part of your value chains. 5 is about public procurement, which I have just mentioned. 6 is about certification, certifying women in business. 7, helping with supply side constraint. 8, it's about financial services, financial inclusion, and ownership rights. It's still a big problem in many parts of the world for women to own assets. So these are the 8 areas of work of the She Trades Initiative. What we want each and every one of you is to undertake to support the She Trades Initiative by accepting to work on at least one of these 8 areas. Now, this is not enough. When I travel around the world and I make these points and I talk about supplier diversity, very often I get the question, well, this is great, but where do I find women suppliers? So we thought that in the 21st century, in the era of technology and digital connectivity, we needed to resolve this issue. We launched a technology challenge last year, open to entrepreneurs all around the world to develop an app to help us with building a directory of women in business. A directory in which anyone wanting to source from women-owned businesses will know where to find these women. This is something you can all find on Google Play. It's shetrades.com. It's an app developed by a young Kenyan entrepreneur that won the competition. I would encourage you all to download it. It's for free and to your networks, make sure that every woman in business that you know is registered in the She Trades. It would be much better. It would help us connect women entrepreneurs to markets. Now, the enabling environment for gender equality obviously goes beyond apps and even beyond the 8 pillars of the call to action. We need far-reaching changes in social, cultural expectations about household duties, about caring work, about child rearing, which currently weigh disproportionately on women, leaving less time for the women to invest in paid work, in networking and in building skills. Social policy for childcare and parental leave can help shift cultural habits and create more time for working mothers. Governments may have to experiment a little bit, not only with voluntary laws, but maybe even, why not, with mandatory laws, is a bit what is happening in Japan. We also need big changes in the way we think about and divide up unpaid work. According to estimates, the unpaid work done by women around the world is roughly equivalent to the annual output of China. Again, facts and figures, it's the easiest way to convince. Of course, a lot of this work simply needs to be done. So it might be good for the GDP data if you paid your neighbor to take care of your kids while they paid you to take care of theirs, but it wouldn't make much economic sense. So I'm not suggesting that we push the argument to the extreme, but unpaid work has to be properly valued. It has to be properly shared. Men also need to step up and share the burden in the home, in the community, and in the workplace. And here, I have to say, Australia has considerable room for improvement. According to OECD data, again, not me, the OECD, men in this country spend an average of 2.9 hours per day on unpaid work, such as cleaning, cooking, and childcare. Women, meanwhile, spend 5.3 hours a day. Now, the good news, because there's always good news in this, you're better than Italy. The bad news, New Zealand is beating you. And even households in my native Spain have a more balanced workload. So to the Aussie men in the room, now you know what you can do to help. Dear friends, over the past three decades, we have seen the world economy transform by the emergence of billion-strong China, billion-strong India, as full economic actors. The large number of women currently on the margins of the global economy are like a third billion, are the third billion. They are poised to transform their own prospects, and ours too. At ITC, we are trying to contribute to this, directly connecting women-owned businesses to markets and trying to put in place enabling tools and policies to achieve that. But I'm sure we can do better, and certainly we can do more together, men and women together. This is not an issue just simply for women. This is a societal issue. We certainly can do better to make a reality of women's economic empowerment and make sure that this is for the benefit of our economies, societies, and families. Thanks a lot for your attention, and obviously delighted to take questions, comments, observations, and even disagreements if you have them. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. excuse me, my name is Leon Berkelmans. I'm the director of the International Economy Program here at the Lowy Institute. Your statistic that Australia ranks 63rd in terms of equal pay for equal work is striking. Mm-hmm. Do you have any theories as to why Australia performs so badly there, and what other countries are occupying similar ranks? Where are we? Which countries do we compare to there?
Shall we take a few questions, maybe? And then I'll...
Arantxa, thank you so much, a fantastic talk. I was wondering if you could just cherry pick three really good programs from anywhere in the world and just talk about them very briefly that are really accelerating the issue of women in trade and accelerating outputs of women in trade. Thank you.
I'm going to do something that could possibly get me fired because Arantxa is my boss. But I think I have an obligation to ask this question because it's coming through Twitter to your speech. So someone has asked, how will you deal with women possibly losing big time through the TPP and through the impact of climate change, especially Indigenous women? And this is coming from an Indigenous organization here in Australia.
So let me take this first batch of questions, and then we will move on to the next. Equal pay for equal job. It's a function of two things, essentially. First is the salary level. Two is the type of activities that the women are active in. If you are on the low part of your value chain, if you are at the part of the lower productivity of the economic activities, if you are in the lowest paid activities in your economy, there is going to be, by definition, an equal pay for equal job gap. So I think part of what countries must do is understand what is driving this this big gap in pay. Every country is different. So I don't think there is one solution that fits every country. It depends on whether you have a big informal sector, you've got a small informal sector, your economy is built on services, your economy is built on manufacturing, your economy is on farming. But my advice is get the data, get the analysis. And this is why it's so important to collect sex disaggregated data. And this is why I'm so disappointed by the work done so far on this in the Sustainable Development Goals that we all agreed to last September in New York. I think we need to unpack the economic empowerment of women. We need better disaggregated data, and we certainly should not measure the level of women's empowerment by just simply looking at the number of women in parliament that we have, which is a bit the measure that we traditionally use. We have to go well below that. The good news is that a lot of private companies are doing this. Why is it? Because they have bought in this idea that diversity is good for the companies, and they are now starting to unpack this. And you have many companies doing an evaluation of, are they equal pay for equal job? And pledging to be equal pay for equal job. So advice, understand what is driving the difference, and act on the drivers that would change this. Companies are doing this. Governments must do that. I wouldn't want to tell you who is in the ranking, but you know, just take the WEF ranking. It's publicly available, WEF.org. Good practices on women's connecting women to trade. For example, very interesting program driven by Barclays in Africa to provide trade credit for women in business through an accreditation system that is in which we are partners with them. But it's about surgically addressing the access to finance, problem that many women face in order to be in business. Good example of connecting women to markets, Chile, in the technology space, wanting to identify women in technology. And in Brazil, women in technology, and help them connect to markets. So that it's not just about women in agriculture, or women in textiles, or women in footwear, which are the stories that we know, and which are great stories, but there is also women in technology. Then let me give you a third example, childcare policy in Norway, that is helping with liberating space and time for women to be, again, active players in trade and in the economy. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, I think it's an interesting signal when I hear trade ministers talk about small and medium enterprises, and when I hear them talk about women's economic empowerment. Because this means they've understood that for trade policy and for trade agreements to be accepted and acceptable at home and to be voted by parliaments, they need to be also instruments of inclusive growth. So I was particularly happy to see a chapter on small and medium enterprises, for example, in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because I think it gives a signal that trade policymakers have understood that it's important to ensure that trade agreements are also going to contribute. They are going to be instruments for more inclusive growth at home. Now, let me be very clear on this, because I think sometimes there is a bit of this is not very well understood. Trade agreements create opportunities. Trade agreements don't create results. They open up opportunities. These opportunities have to be also, obviously, when a trade negotiator negotiates a trade agreement, it wants to create opportunities for those sectors of the economy where his or her country has a comparative advantage. But a trade agreement doesn't guarantee results. This is why you need more than trade agreements to ensure that trade works for all. And this is why I sometimes, I must say, have a bit of trouble with those that think that we're going to fix the problems of the economy just by erecting trade barriers. Because this would essentially mean that they would be depriving their companies of opportunities. So instead of erecting walls and barriers to international trade, I think the answer is rather to ensure the opportunities that are negotiated in trade agreements do translate for SMEs, do translate for the smallholder farmer, do translate for the woman in business, do translate for the less than $1 a day woman in a slum in Nairobi, and do translate, frankly speaking, today for the thousands, for the millions of refugees that could participate in the economy and are not. So the question is not, let's shut trade, but let's make sure that we use trade as a creator of opportunities, complementing this with, in particular for poorer countries, a good doses of aid for trade, the development, the part of development aid that goes to boost the supply side capacity of countries to participate in international trade. Climate change is a huge issue. I just came from Fiji, where we have been working in the last 3 years to connect farmers, many of them women farmers, in areas of Fiji, in Rakiraki, in Kora Island, in Vanua Valavu. For those of you that know a little bit of Fiji, these are very remote places of the country. We have connected them to international markets. We've been working with them for 3 years, improving the quality of their products, very often niche products that markets such as Australia is interested in paying a high premium for. My trip to Fiji was meant to be a joyous moment when we would open a processing center, a couple of processing centers that we have been working on with these hundreds of farmers. But it turns out that Winston cyclone wiped out all the work that we had done in the last 3 years. And as if it was not enough, at the beginning of this week, two tropical storms with torrential rains drained the rest of what was left. So climate change is a huge issue. This is not a dream. For these people in these parts of the world, with limited resources, with limited assets, with small markets, climate change is today's nightmare. This is why it is so important that we together find ways to reduce CO2 emissions, and thus is a collective effort. It's not, you know, frankly, it's not going to solve the problem if the little islands reduce CO2 emissions. The bigger CO2 emitters have to do that. And beyond that, it is extremely important that measures are taken to improve the resilience of these economies and the resilience of the economic actors in these economies, many of whom are, again, poor farmers, many of whom are poor women farmers. Did I miss the question on? Did I miss your question, which was? Yeah. No, this is what I put into the social cultural change. There is a soft part in this enterprise of women's economic empowerment, which is about changing mentalities. Now, you change mentalities in different ways. You change mentalities with laws that impose diversity. You change mentalities with role modeling. You change mentalities by showing that this can also happen, that the company is also thriving, that the company is making good business when the top of the company is a woman, when the top of the company is a minority woman. But we have to show these examples. And I have to say we are not that good at showing those examples. And I have to say that we in the media don't use enough the power of media. Now, luckily, we all have media in our phones. We all have social media through which we all can explain and express all these role models that are out there. There are thousands of them. I mean, I meet thousands of these people in my travels around the world. This is a reality, but we have to make them more visible. So changing social change, changing mentalities, traditions, the legal route, it's one way. Some are doing it in that way, imposing diversity with quotas, But also beyond that, making sure that we have a story to tell and we tell the story over and over again until it becomes the norm.
Hi. I wanted to talk to you about the economic empowerment that's led to the two-career household. And I wanted to talk about how there's a lot of ideas kind of in sort of feminist academia at the moment about how white, middle, upper-class women and their economic empowerment into professions has relied upon the employment of housekeepers and nannies and domestic workers. And there's an argument that the empowerment of these women has benefited from the oppression of race and class in certain spheres. I was wondering what you kind of thought about that, or if you're kind of acquainted with these ideas, that the two-career household for certain classes has led to a greater economic disparity for some other women.
Thank you, Arantxa. I'm interested in some examples of functioning public procurement policies that are generating real impacts on women's economic empowerment, and perhaps what we could be doing here.
Okay, so on the public procurement, two good examples, one in the north, one in the south, the US in the north, Kenya in the south. These are countries where the government has made a concerted effort, it's not just lip service, it has made a concerted effort at ensuring that the public procurement markets are crafted in a way such that it provides opportunities for all actors. In the US, this is in the form of a Small Business Act with a specific considerations for women in business, same in Kenya. The question is not to pretend that we are going to give women, award women government procurement contracts, even if they are the worst in terms of quality, or even if they are the worst in terms of prices. Is that the manner in which we craft public procurement contracts has an impact on who will be able to bid. For example, if you are the Kenyan army and you are procuring uniforms for the army, or if you are the Kenyan healthcare system and you're procuring towels for the hospitals, and you say, I am purchasing, say, $10 million of towels. By definition, small players in that market will not be able to participate in that market because the threshold is too high. If you have a policy that says for every contract for which you bid, you have to pre-qualify. And pre-qualifying means that you have to deposit a sum of money before you participate in every contract. By definition, small players will not be able to have deep pockets to pre-qualify for every contract. Let's imagine that you do it a bit differently. You say, I want to procure towels. I'm going to procure in lots of 200,000, 200,000, 200,000, 200,000. You open opportunities for many more suppliers that are of smaller size to this market. Now, I am not suggesting that every government does this for every product. What I'm suggesting is you look at what is the offer that is available around you, and what is it, where is it that it makes sense to craft your procurement bids in a manner that would allow smaller players to be part of that market. If you're procuring planes, I don't think you should bother with that. You can't slice planes, okay? If you're procuring military arms or tanks and whatever, I don't think it makes sense. But if you're procuring cleaning services, if you're procuring IT services, then why not? So these are two examples. The US has even set a target for itself. It wants 5% of its procurement market to go to women. This is an initiative that was launched under President Clinton. And they are just now getting to the 5%. So even in a market like the US, it's taking place. But the argument is very simple, frankly. If it is $15 trillion, moving the needle from 1% to 1.5% would already make a huge impact. Now, on the two career households, we have a market. We have a market in which there is demand. There is demand for CEOs, there is demand for teachers, there is demand for IT specialists, and there is demand for nannies. And I don't think that there should be anything wrong in accepting that there is demand for nannies. It's a huge market. Now, the question is whether only certain types and only certain sectors of the economy end up being nannies because there is no other opportunities for these people, or whether we create opportunities for them in other parts of the economy in which they would like to participate. So for me, the question is not so the two-career household. I think we have to accept that this is a job. It's a job as decent and as noble as any other job. The problem is if this job is the only job available for certain categories of women, say those that are of a certain race, with a certain background, in certain from certain neighborhoods, because the system does not offer, our economy doesn't offer them any other opportunities. So nothing wrong with it, except when it becomes discriminatory, meaning you don't have an access to anything else than that.
Just a quick one. You made a passing reference to certification or accreditation of women's businesses. I just want to understand a little bit more about what was intended by that, because it sounds like a potentially very big job.
So who is a woman-owned business? Is it the woman-owned business, the man who says his wife is the owner of the company? So certifying a woman in business is understanding what is a woman in business. Is it a shell woman in business, or is it the real woman in business? So this is why there is a certification process, where there is a process to demonstrate that you are a woman owned business when you own 51% or more of the assets of a company, and you or you exercise control over the assets of the company, so that we start counting what is really a woman owned business. So certification is the process through which we are going to be doing that. The problem is that there is today no common definition. There is no standard for what a woman in business, women-owned business is. And it would merit a bit of a discussion if we at least had a set of agreed principles that anybody else would then, you know, whether it's through an ISO standard, which would be maybe a good way to proceed, we would have, like we have for many other things in our economy, is that we have a standard definition so that we start measuring things that look the same, basically.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Leon Berkowitz. I'm the International Economy Program Director here at Lowy. I thoroughly enjoyed Arantxa's talk. It was very entertaining, I thought passionate, and wonderful in its use of data. So there were audible gasps from the audience with some of the anecdotes or stories, actually, that Arantxa told. And I think that really speaks to the power of data, and really speaks to one of the profound things that I think Arantxa said, was that what we need to do is start measuring this problem a bit more. There was an article written this week by Larry Summers, not someone who has a glorious history when it comes to matters of gender equality. He made some very controversial marks probably about a decade ago on that topic, but they're not easily forgotten. But nonetheless, he wrote this wonderful piece in the Financial Times this week that just made the point that a lot of progress in society comes from just measuring stuff better. And I think that that's a really important point, and I think that's one of the things I'm really going to take from this talk. So ladies and gentlemen, would you please join me in giving Arantxa a warm vote of thanks, and we hope to see you again here at Lowy sometime soon.